everyone. Dan Delman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. For those of you who have been waiting, the wait is at an end. Climate change is here. The connection between hellacious weather and man-made climate change is becoming undeniable. For years, climate scientists have been wary of attributing extreme weather directly to man-made atmospheric warming. But that's changing in the face of historic heat waves and cascading natural disasters. In recent weeks alone, a derecho, a complex of unusually powerful hurricane-like storms, tore through the Midwest, destroying homes and crops across a 745-mile path. Hurricane Laura crashed into the Gulf Coast with sustained 150-mile-per-hour winds, and hundreds of California wildfires incinerated an area the size of Rhode Island in just 1 week. The Southwest suffered a punishing heat wave with a high temperature of 130 degrees in Death Valley, perhaps the hottest day in world history. It followed highs of 125 in Iraq and a record 100 degree day in the Siberian town of Verkhoyansk. A once in 100,000 years event. These freak patterns are almost certainly the result of mankind pumping over 2.5 million pounds of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere per second. We've gotten to the point where, when it comes to extreme heat waves, there is almost always a human fingerprint. Well, just how strange is recent weather? The expression 500-year storm is losing its meaning. Houston has suffered five of them in a five-year span. California's wildfires, ignited by 1,200 lightning strikes in 72 hours, produced the second and third worst blazes in state history. Even without the aid of the fall's Santa Ana winds. The Atlantic coast has already seen 10 named storms, a mark typically it doesn't reach until October. And upcoming storms are projected to be twice as intense as usual. Why? Because of extremely warm ocean waters. Hurricanes have done over $330 billion in damage over the past 3 years, compared with only $38 billion across the entire 1980s. Climate disasters of all types inflicted $800 billion in damage during the 2010s. This was the hottest decade on record. Weather patterns are shaped by an intricate web of atmospheric and oceanic conditions. And that is why scientists traditionally resist drawing causal links between climate change and any one event. But when both rising temperatures and disasters become consistent and pervasive, the connection becomes obvious. The average daily highs in Northern California during wildfire season are 3 to 4 degrees warmer than they were in 1900. Warming of the planet's surface causes atmospheric instability that can produce stronger, more frequent storms while rising ocean temperatures and unusually moist air spawn hurricanes, and these hurricanes grow rapidly more powerful, then stall after making landfall and dump torrential rain. How else is climate change felt? Well, disrupted weather patterns are rippling around the globe, creating bizarre and almost biblical catastrophes. Extreme temperatures in the Indian Ocean cause drought and wildfires in Australia, while spawning cyclones in eastern Africa. The torrential rain in eastern Africa created perfect conditions for desert locusts, which reproduced at terrifying rates. And by last March, hundreds of billions of the finger-length insects swept across the region, devouring every crop in their path and pushing tens of millions of Africans to the brink of starvation. People are even experiencing climate change through their sinuses. Airborne pollen increases as temperatures climb, which is why residents of Alaska, where warming is happening twice as fast as the global average, report especially bad allergies this year. There's irrefutable data that this is occurring, according to Jeffrey DeMaine, who's director of an Alaskan Allergy Center. Well, just what does the future hold? Much depends on the oceans, which play a critical role in absorbing CO2 and heat and regulating weather. The amount of heat we have put in the world's oceans in the past 25 years equals 3.6 billion Hiroshima atom bomb explosions, according to a Beijing physics professor. Warming oceans are circulating more slowly, by about 15% in the Atlantic Ocean since 1950. The reduction in their moderating influence could cause warmer summers, colder winters, changing rainfall patterns, and more destructive storms. Climate change is no longer a theoretical threat. In California, average temperatures have climbed almost 2 degrees since 1980, while precipitation has dropped 30%. And this doubled the number of extreme risk days for wildfires each year. A few weeks ago, a rancher by the name of Taylor Craig drove for his life as flames raced toward his Northern California home. Later, in a Walmart parking lot, Craig said he realized he had joined a new and growing club. He said, "I'm a disaster refugee." Why are California wildfires so intense this year? With torrential lightning storms, hundreds of fires, and more than 120,000 people evacuated, California is confronting a once-in-a-generation fire season. As COVID-19 hamstrings the state's containment and evacuation plans, Millions in the American West are watching a tragedy of circumstance. Environmental intrusion, decades of government inaction, and high winds have forced the situation out of control. Without adequate prevention, scientists predict the country's wildfire seasons will grow in size, and they will also increase in cost in the next 50 years. The national number of acres burned so far is below the yearly average, less than 3 million, compared with the typical 4 to 6 million. Though large population centers are threatened, the fires afflicting them are freaks of nature, rather than more usual results of human malpractice. Locales in fire-dependent ecosystems can lower risk by building more fire-resistant homes and thinning nearby vegetation. State governments can enforce these practices through building codes and using fire extension programs, which integrate experts into at-risk areas for long-term change. In fire-dependent ecosystems, the risk of wildfire will always exist, but it can become more manageable. To reduce the chance of another catastrophic fire season, it may have to be. The long-term view has to be being better prepared for the inevitability of fire. You may be wondering how the Israel-United Arab Emirates peace deal was possible. Well, key questions remain about the conflict between Israel and its Palestinian neighbors and the West Bank territory that Israel captured in the 1967 Six-Day War. But the current treaty, only the third between Israel and an Arab state, followed a drive to cast aside decades-old diplomatic assumptions about the Mideast. The Israel-UAE agreement simply makes public an open secret. For years, the UAE and other Arab states in the Gulf have been engaging quietly with Israel in politics, security, business, even culture and sports. Yet for Israel, the public acceptance of normalization matters hugely. Since the founding of modern Israel in 1948, the Arab world hasn't just rejected the idea of peace, it has questioned Israel's legitimacy. The most powerful moment in the first peace breakthrough was then Egyptian President Anwar Sadat telling the Israeli Knesset in 1977, we used to brand you as so-called Israel. Now I tell you that we welcome you among us. Well, two major political changes made the current deal possible. The first was in the Middle East itself. For many Sunni Muslim Arab states realized, I'll pause here just to explain that term. Islam is divided into two groups, the Sunni and the Shia. The Sunni are in the vast majority, that is, the Shia may have about maybe 15 to 20% of the adherents to Islam, and the rest are Sunni Muslims. So let me rephrase this then. For many Sunni Muslim Arab states, the conflict with Israel has taken a backseat to concern over Shiite Iran. That's especially true for Gulf Arab states like the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Bahrain, directly across from Iran. For them, Israel's strength and intelligence, cyber science and technology make cooperation attractive. And meanwhile, the big hurdle to normalization, the Arab world's commitment to Palestinians, has eroded. The Israeli-Palestinian peace process has stalled. The Palestinian leadership is split, and charges of mismanagement and corruption have weakened its popular support. Equally important has been political change in the United States. The run-up to the Israel-UAE deal began with an implicit message. The Palestinians, having turned down previous proposals for a two-state peace, were in no position to dictate terms. Washington drove home the point by moving its embassy to Jerusalem, the status of which, under decades of U.S. policy, was to be resolved only as a part of a final peace. But the move elicited barely a murmur of Arab opposition. And so the key question that I started this with about the Palestinian people and the West Bank is not supported as heavily as it has been. Then the USA went even further. It greenlit Israel's desire to annex parts of the West Bank. That was too far for many Arab states, including the UAE. But that was the cue for the other key factor of the U.S. new approach, seeking a limited transactional deal. Everybody got something. The UAE got closer ties with Israel on intelligence and cyber capability, and the prospect of buying top-end U.S. weaponry. It also got regional political cover. Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu retreated from annexation of the West Bank. Israel got the promise of peace with an Arab country. Mr. Netanyahu got a political boost while shelving an annexation plan from which he was backing off anyway. But what about the Palestinians? The answer is still unclear, and it raises a more fundamental issue. The old core U.S. assumption in the Middle East, we're not simply hidebound orthodoxy. Permanent Israeli control over and settlement of the West Bank were viewed as a violation of international law and an unwelcome precedent for the wider world. Israeli-Palestinian peace was seen as good, not only for both parties, but also for regional and U.S. interests. But with the rise of Iran, war in Syria, political and economic crises in Lebanon, Turkey's new assertiveness, and the re-entry of Russia into the fray, U.S. policymakers now will have to ask whether their long-held judgments still matter. And now it's back into outer space. And I look at the Milky Way's rogue planets. There may be more than 100 billion rogue planets drifting through the Milky Way, according to recent research. While most planets, like our own, orbit a sun, many others are starless and roam freely through space. These planets may have formed around stars and have been flung out into space or formed from dense clouds of interstellar gas and dust. The existence of rogue planets has been known for decades, but their prevalence remains a mystery, because they are too dark to be seen by telescopes. Astronomers hope that all will change with the Roman Galactic Exoplanet Survey, which is a NASA mission scheduled for 2025 that will use a revolutionary new telescope to create panoramic pictures of space in unprecedented detail. Computer simulations suggest that the telescope will be able to detect hundreds of rogue planets in just part of the Milky Way, meaning that the galaxy as a whole must contain hundreds of billions. This is a totally new frontier for astronomers and scholars of outer space. We're headed toward the end of the program today, but I have a couple of items that I think we should look at. One is the shortage of automobiles that has sent prices rocketing. New car prices are up an average of $1,200 and used cars about $900 in a perfect seller's market. In other recessions, prices fell as incomes dropped. But this time, the pandemic shut down production for 2 months. But buyers came back to the market sooner than expected. Pandemic concerns about public transportation have boosted demand, and dealers have become more adept at selling online. Most of the increases in new car prices, now an average of $38,000, have gone right to dealers' profits, which have risen from $300 to $1,100 per vehicle. And in the used car market, dealers are fighting over scarce inventory, which means you'll get more for your trade-in right now if you decide to upgrade. Wait, though, until the program is over. And that brings us toward the end of the day. And I want to thank you for tuning in to another edition of A Little of This and A Little of That. I do enjoy having you with me. Please come back. Remember now, wear your mask, social distancing. That helps us all. If we stick together, we'll get through this. We've gotten through other things before that we were really worried about and tested our mettle. But I think we can do it this time. Goodbye. Good luck. And see you soon.